You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 83 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Tension Between East and West, 10 lectures translated by B.A. Rowley. This is Lecture 4, entitled Anthroposophy and World Evolution from a Geographical Standpoint, given in Vienna on June 4, 1922. We describe the features of the earth in accordance with the principles of physical geography. In the same way, the spiritual impulses at work on earth, already briefly characterized in these lectures, can be described by a kind of spiritual geography, especially the interplay of Eastern and Western impulses in human life, with all their various differences. What I have to say today in this direction is bound to remain rather rudimentary, but it is more important to find a specific point of view from which to consider some aspects of what I have already outlined, than to give a detailed description. The relationship between East and West is often expressed symbolically by saying that light comes from the East. Looking at the East, the Westerner, or anyone belonging to modern civilization in general, receives the impression of a dreamlike spiritual life. Modern spiritual life is accustomed to sharply delineated concepts, closely linked to external observation. By contrast, the ideas of the East, which are far livelier, more fluid, less closely and sharply linked to externals, appear dreamlike. Admittedly, from this dreamlike spiritual life, embodied in the most splendid poems, the Vedas, there did, of course, then develop the clear-cut concepts of a comprehensive philosophy, Vedanta, for example. These concepts were not gained by examining external data, that is, analytically, but emerged from an inwardly experienced and apprehended spiritual life. When this dreamlike spiritual life works on us, however, and we lovingly submit to it, without at first noticing how much it differs from our own, it has a curious effect. Once we allow its various configurations to affect our soul, we cannot stop there. We cannot merely take up its concepts and ideas. In absorbing them, whether from literature or philosophy, including such forms of these as have survived in the East down to the present, we feel a spiritual need to go beyond these images, ideas, and concepts, and something then arises before the soul's gaze. When an Oriental idea, such as that of man's relation to the secrets and the mysterious workings of nature and the world, affects us, we cannot help but allow there to grow before us in spirit that which is also a symbol in the Orient for such a concept, the lotus flower, as it wraps its petals around what must remain mysteriously hidden. We may immerse ourselves lovingly in mobile concepts, in concepts that are more fitted gently to touch external phenomena and surround them with a mist than to grasp them in sharp contours. And we may enter their intertwining branches, and if we do, there will inevitably appear to us all the intertwining, branching vegetation of the East, and with it all that the human hand, the human spirit and civilization have produced from stone and other materials in line with these flowing, branching concepts. We may say, in immersing itself in these concepts, our soul inevitably sees before it a nature similar in its life, diversity, and imaginative working to what is experienced by the soul in the concepts, in the inner pictures of this Oriental spiritual activity. In my view, there does not appear to be any external reason to go from this spiritual activity over to a, quote, faithful observation of nature, close quote. Rather, it seems to me, that there lies in the Oriental concepts themselves an incentive, not merely to accept them, but to apply them to the outer world. Europeans may feel that such concepts cannot be applied to the outer world because of their vagueness, their, to them, fantastic character. If so, we may ask, How then can we track with sharply delineated concepts the shapes of clouds, fluctuating and rapidly changing as they are? Yet track them we must if we wish to observe nature's workings in their immediate manifestations, as they appear to the human senses and the human soul. Why is this so? It seems to me that there can be only one reason, that in what reaches us from this Eastern spiritual activity, there survives an element from which it was once directly created. At the time when the Oriental was developing the finest part of his worldview, which has since come down to his descendants in a partially decadent condition, the East created everything with devoted love. Love lives in each of its ideas, concepts, and images, and in them we perceive love. The love seeks to flow out into objects, and it flows out according to its nature and conjures up before our soul the symbols that the Oriental established, with an inner understanding of much that works supersensibly, in seeking to establish what he felt as the spiritual element in things. Of course, this is not to assert that this configuration of spirit, if extended over all the earth, would be an unmixed blessing for world evolution. But once it has appeared on earth and exerted its influence over other regions, it must be considered objectively, especially at a time when we need to foster understanding among human beings. In contrast, we may place before us the particular outlook that has developed, certainly with no less justification, but in a quite different form, further west, and in this respect we ourselves belong, in many ways, to the West. Here we find it is regarded as an ideal to stand back from what the senses observe directly, what extends in space and time, and to test what nature offers, what should lead us to the world's secret, according to position, motion, dimensions, and weight. One dissects what appears directly to the eye, EYE, places it under the microscope, and then builds conceptions that can only arise under a microscope. Let us imagine for a moment that we are in the laboratory, how heavily equipped we are with these concepts, so remote from direct observation. Look how we regard the light flooding through the world, how we regard it by means of abstract concepts. We need them if we are to reach understanding, but how remote are the observations we record of light and color from what we encounter in wood and meadow, cloud shape and sun? We may say what we formulate in our sharply delineated concepts using scales, measurements, and the most varied counting devices takes us into some of nature's shallows and solves some riddles. But it does not take us to direct observation of nature. It is all very well to say, direct your attention to sensory observation and then try to derive your worldview from it. But this is not what happens at all. The scientific worldview we establish is far removed from what the senses observe. What we ought to say is this: if we establish our knowledge by using the equipment of learning with which we have harvested perhaps the finest fruits of modern natural science, we shall have to retune our soul before we can approach nature again. If, as botanists, we have used the microscope extensively and learned about cell life, and formed concepts in the atomistic manner of today, we shall have to retune our soul before we can recapture a love of the immediate world of plants as it grows and flowers. If we have formed a scientific concept of the structure of animal and man, again we shall have to retune if we want to move on to direct observation of the animal's form and actions, and to enjoy the way it plays in the meadow, or turns its melancholy or unmoving gaze upon us, or looks at us confidingly. Equally, we shall have to retune our soul to share in what the eye, EYE, can see when it looks at the human form, tracing its planes with an artistic eye. The Oriental has no retuning to do. Since what he called his science was shot through with love, It led him out to immediate observation. And this was a direct echo of what he experienced in his soul. These are differences of disposition in the way life is viewed in East and West. And these different dispositions combine in diverse ways in the human being of the middle. In what we experience scientifically, artistically, and religiously, there flows much of the disposition I have just been characterizing as the one that comes to us from the Orient. In other respects, we are moved by something of the way of experiencing the world kindled by that scientific attitude which the West has developed, by youthful science and knowledge, so to speak, as against the old established knowledge of the East. And in every soul in the civilization that lies between, these two currents flow together. In the last analysis, the life that surrounds us in Europe is a merging of different streams, and we today must really come to understand what it is that is merging here. The contact between the dispositions of East and West in our present spiritual life can be characterized in another way. From what I have just said of the East, one thing is clear about the Oriental. In growing into his spiritual life, he experiences it as immediate reality. He bears it with him in his soul as the reality self-evident to him. External nature, and indeed the entire external world, right up to the constellations, seems to him an echo that is, however, fundamentally the same as what he bears within him. Yet he cannot regard as reality what strikes him as an echo, what seems to him a reflection, in the same way as he can regard as reality what he experiences directly in his soul. He is closely linked with what he experiences in the spiritual sphere and can say, quote, "It is," close quote, because he feels its existence as if it were his own, and in this way understands its mode of being. When he looks out at the reflection of this existence, he knows that it is not reality in the same sense. If he did not illuminate it with the light that streams from within him, it would be dumb and dark. And in becoming more and more aware of this, he arrives at a soul disposition that says truth and reality reside in what the soul experiences directly. What is reflected to it from without is illusion, maya, incomplete reality, becoming reality only when it is touched by what must first reveal itself through the human soul. Thus we see how the East developed the view that the spiritual world is reality, and the outer world, that of the senses, is semblance, the great illusion, maya. It would, however, be wrong to believe on this account that in the pre-Buddhist period, for example, the Oriental averted his gaze completely from the outer world. He accepts it, even if, in a higher sense, he must admit that in what extends in space and time, he is dealing not with complete reality, but with an illusion, the great non-being, maya. But this, in turn, gives a particular disposition to the life of the soul in the East. The soul feels a close link with the spiritual world and sees in all that exists in the external world of the senses a reflection of the original form of the world as it exists in the spirit. And in the end, this grows into the view that one's own human sensory being is a reflection of a human being whose true existence is in the spiritual world. And here I would say, the Oriental, quite consistently, regards the world as made up of reflections of a spiritual world, just as he regards himself as a reflection of what he was before he descended into the physical sensory world. From his standpoint, the view of man and the view of nature are in complete harmony. This harmony is possible, though no longer consonant with our views. It does indeed express a truth, if somewhat one-sidedly, as we can see once again if with the research methods of spiritual science, which I have been describing in the last few days, we ourselves take a look at this Oriental disposition toward knowledge. As I have shown, by awakening powers dormant in the soul, we can attain a view of the spiritual world that suits modern man. We can look once more into a spiritual world and find this spiritual world unfolding before our spiritual eye, EYE, just as the physical sensory world unfolds before our physical eye. When we develop this vision, however, the spiritual world does not remain a mere pantheistic and nebulous embodiment of universal spirituality. It becomes just as concrete in its individual forms as is the world of the senses in the individual forms of nature. There will then follow a view of man that I should now like to characterize. Let us start with something familiar to us at every moment in our lives, an experience of the outer world. We have entered into this external experience through our sensory perception, and perhaps also through setting our will in motion in some activity. We live in conjunction with the facts of the outer world. For us, this is an immediate experience. Human existence on earth is essentially composed of such experiences. From them, we retain thought images, which become our memories. We can look back on our experiences through bearing within us faded, shadowy, and indeed thought-like images of them. Let us be quite honest with ourselves and consider whether at any moment in life our consciousness contains very much more than memories of external, factual, sensory experiences. Of course, many a nebulous mystic believes that he can summon up eternal things from the depths of his soul. If he looked more closely and could really test the structures he summons from his soul, he would discover that as a rule they are no more than transformed external perceptions. Within man, memories are not only faithfully preserved, they are also transformed in many ways, and he then fails to recognize them. He thinks that he is acting as a mystic and summoning something from the depths of his soul, when he has only called up from his memory a transformed external experience. Of course, we need only think of mathematical truths to realize that all kinds of inner structures do work their way into the life of the soul. But as a rule, it is not these structures that the mystic seeks. However, anyone who simply wishes to accept the everyday life of the soul, as it appears in ordinary consciousness, must say this life is made up of images that are the remains of our experiences gained through perceptions and of other experiences within the external sensory world. When we look at our soul and at the spiritual element that permeates it, as we have it in physical life on earth, we can therefore say, outside is the physical world extending in space, the world that unfolds its causes and effects in time, the world that is a fact. Here, within, is the world of shadows in the soul. We do indeed experience it in general as something spiritual and vital, but its content we experience only as a reflection of the world of facts and of the senses. Now, paradoxical as the outlook of today may find it, for the attitude that I have been expounding in the last few days, the reverse comes about. In empty consciousness, as a result of meditation, the spiritual in the world, the spiritual within natural phenomena, is really experienced. It is observed also as the sole spiritual element in man himself, as he is before he descends into his physical existence from a spiritual world. The spiritual is observed concretely by the spiritual organ we have developed. The world about us becomes spiritual, just as to our senses it is sensory, physical. And when all this happens, we begin to perceive, as if in recollection of the times when we lived as spiritual beings in purely spiritual worlds, how in its particulars our physical organism is a reflection of the spiritual world that surrounds us. With physiology and anatomy, we can observe our lungs, heart, and other organs only as outer objects. But when we can see the spiritual world around us, then the lungs and heart, as they really are within us, will become for us a reflection in the physical sphere of what is spiritually prefigured. Just as in our ordinary consciousness, the world outside is physical, and our soul creates reflections as its experiences, so now we learn that there is a spiritual world outside, and that the reflections of this spiritual world are present in our own organs. We come to know man's structure only in coming to know the spiritual world. What is usually called matter then ceases to have the significance it has assumed in recent civilization, just as spirit ceases to have the significance of something abstract that it has had in recent civilization. We can thus see that in our organic functions, there is in fact a reflection of what we were before we descended into our earthly existence. At this stage, we need no longer be frightened, even by materialism, insofar as there is justification for it. And even materialism has done some good and brought us countless discoveries. We look at the human brain and the human nervous system in its physical operation. Of course, we agree that ordinary, everyday thinking is a function of these physical organs. We are entirely in agreement with what exact science must say about these matters today. But on the other hand, we know that the material forms operating within us are themselves simply a transformed reflection of the spiritual sphere. It can be material because the material is a transformation of the spiritual, because the spiritual, by transforming itself into earthly man, has sought out the capacity of brain and nerves to achieve in a material reflection what is spiritually prefigured. The modern human being can see this with his spiritual eye, EYE, by developing the powers of cognition of which I have been speaking in the last few days. Yet there is a dreamlike anticipation of it, I would say, in the Oriental worldview I have briefly outlined. This worldview has become old, but certain of its features still work their way into our heart and soul. In its instinctive clairvoyance, the ancient Orient sensed that the spiritual world is a reality with which it felt closely linked, and that nature and the natural element in man himself is a reflection of the spiritual. It provides an external garment for the revelation of what is inwardly spiritual. Yet it would be wrong to say that the Oriental did not observe nature. His organs were finely attuned to its observation. For him, however, from everything that he faithfully observed and lovingly honored as a reflection, something of the spirit shone. Nature revealed spirit to him, shone spirit upon him at every turn. And the spirit was his reality. What lay before him in the outer world was Maya. Even in Buddhism, which gained a far greater influence on Oriental life than we usually think, since it later assumed the most varied forms, we can see how the sense of inhabiting a spiritual world paled in the course of human and world evolution. The gaze was increasingly directed upon what was Maya, and experience of the great illusion, the great non-being, Maya, gradually became predominant. There thus arose an awareness of the need for redemption from what can be experienced within Maya, experienced, that is, in the manner of Buddha, who regarded our direct experiences of this Maya as a host of sorrows that stream in on us. But it faded, this sense of inhabiting a spiritual world. And this is what justifies us in considering the early Oriental worldview as something instinctive and even one-sided. If we do return to something like it, we must do so with complete self-possession and lucid consciousness. A paralysis of human activity in relation to the demands of the physical external world must not occur a second time in world evolution. Man must never again escape into spiritual activity, and so prevent himself from devoting his full strength to earthly tasks, which are what the Oriental feels as Maya, even if in deference to modern concepts he does not say so, while he feels as reality what reveals itself within him. He has within him a light that is a direct reflection of the divine spiritual in the world. In contrast to what I have thus described as the spiritual geography influencing our modern life, I would now like to consider another example from the evolution of the human spirit and the world, but this time from the immediate present. Our civilization, which even in Europe is now of some antiquity, is subject to pressures from certain spheres, whence arise social longings and also social conflicts. Anyone who has moved in these spheres will have come across the phenomenon I am about to describe. Although no one could properly accuse me of having socialist views, I was for some long time a teacher in socialist circles. My intention was to do something for which, in fact, the time had not yet come. It is more than 20 years ago now. To promulgate a spiritual life that could lead to structures that are in closer accord with reality than those derived from abstract or modified Marxism, which in many respects indeed are not realistic at all. There exists in these circles a basic attitude, something we can recognize as a beginning, yet which is as deeply rooted in the soul as was the sense of Maya at which the Oriental finally arrived. And in observing this attitude, we are profoundly struck by a word that expresses many unconscious feelings, unconscious ideas and concepts, unconscious longings too. A word that we hear again and again and must recognize as having characterized wide circles of humanity for centuries. Encompassing millions of people is a mood that this word expresses. The word is ideology. It derives from an attitude that the proletarian class in particular has absorbed into its education. Science, becoming increasingly materialistic, has given rise to the view that historical reality consists simply of economic struggles, economic patterns, class struggles, in short, of the immediate material element, the external physical sensory element in human life and history, and that therefore economic forces are the true reality. This economic materialism, which is far more widespread than many upper-class people today believe, is a consequence of the general materialistic outlook, which nowadays is believed to have been overcome even in science. Yet it has a powerful hold on the soul dispositions and attitudes of wide circles of the Occident. And what is this ideology? It is law, morality, the realm of the beautiful, religious concepts, political theory. In short, everything that makes up spiritual life. These things are not true reality, but bubbles and baubles arising from true reality, which resides in material struggles and patterns. Ideology is a way of indicating that what man experiences within himself, whether it is art or science or law or maxims of state or religious impulses, is Maya, to use the Oriental term. If we do not just take it at its face value, but can feel what millions of people are thinking, then the word ideology points to something that must inevitably assume the most formidable dimensions unless it can be set on the right course in good time. What the soul experiences and shapes within is not reality. True reality is only what exists externally in tangible facts. Within Occidental, within Western civilization, therefore, there has developed a disposition diametrically opposed to that which long ruled the Orient and still survives even today as a kind of antiquated trimming. There, true reality is what is experienced in the spirit, and Maya what proceeds outside in physical actuality. Here, Maya, or ideology, which is indeed a translation of the word Maya, but applied to the spiritual sphere, is what is experienced in the spirit, and reality, what is tangibly displayed, palpably, there in the world. In its development, the world aims at complete realization of its various potentialities. Just as the one extreme developed in the Orient, so too the other was bound, in its turn, to take hold of humanity. To bring about a fruitful development of humanity and of the world, however, and to change the forces of decline into constructive forces, we must understand the significance of this disposition, this ideology. It is recent and, therefore, a beginning. Let us look once more at what modern spiritual science can tell us. In the Orient, there was a dreamy, dark, instinctive knowledge that there is a spiritual reality with a sensory reflection here in the physical realm. Because the soul's attention was devoted primarily to this spiritual reality, sensory reality came to be regarded as unreality, external appearance, Maya. Yet this Maya is important in more than one way. Although the world may be Maya, our work, which is a reality for us, must still be applied to it in the first instance. But it also has significance for the precept, know thyself, for a truly human attitude. Why? Well, it is true that we can now elevate ourselves to a life in the spiritual world, as I have described, that we can see by means of sharply delineated concepts, and thus understand what appeared to the Orient like a dream. But the experience of such a world would never have created in human evolution the impulse to freedom. When man feels closely linked to the spiritual world, he feels at the same time inwardly determined by and dependent on it. Therefore he and his consciousness had to move out of it. And for a passing phase of history, in which we now are, to turn to a world of mere fact. Confronted by this external world of facts, the life of the human soul becomes an image of it. That which as spirit pervades this soul life turns into abstract concepts and gradually becomes a mere image, to be recognized as a reflection. I have already suggested that when we bear images within us, we can be free. Mirror images do not determine our actions. If we wish to conform to mirror images, which in themselves are powerless, the impulse to do so must come from us. The same is true of abstract concepts. And in making its appearance in pure thinking, our noblest feature, the moral religious element, becomes for us an impulse of freedom. It is a most valuable content for human life. But in a period when man finds himself confronted with a physical world of facts, it makes its appearance in abstract thinking. At the moment when the moral element in the form of moral intuition makes its appearance in pure thinking, the task of the epoch is fulfilled. The epoch has developed from spirit reality to the spirit as abstraction, and I would say somewhat radically, it now interprets everything spiritual as Maya, as mere illusion, as ideology. We have a certain right to interpret as ideology everything that is a mirror image of external natural existence. At the moment when the moral element in the form of moral intuition enters this Maya thinking, this ideology, we reach the first stage at which we can recognize once more that we must awaken this ideology, which we experience as mere semblance, to inner life, by energizing ourselves and allowing the life that is hidden within us to stream forth. The meaning of the word had to become ideology for humanity, in order that man himself could infuse it with his own reality. This was necessary for humanity's experience of freedom, which is something that has only been attained in the West and in recent civilization. It was necessary that man should first feel himself to be in a sphere of unreality, when in contact with everything that is most valuable to him, his art, his science, his moral concepts, in short, his entire spiritual life, and that everything transitory that shone on him should appear to be the only reality. For this reality, rightly contemplated, cannot in any way impair his freedom, the freedom that depends on his being himself a spiritual being, who creates in the physical sensory world of facts only an image of the spirit. We see, therefore, that ideology represents, in an extreme form, an attitude that we really need in face of such concepts of nature as position, motion, measure, and number. If nature were to provide us with anything other than concepts, it would never make us free. Only if we rise to concepts that will then appear as mere ideology to someone who is still stranded at the previous stage, can a new and spiritually real form of the higher world infuse these initially unreal concepts. This is the first step from which must emerge for man a new form of the spiritual world. And when the experience of ideology approaches us in a one-sided way, those of us who are not bogged down in the immediate opinions of the day, but are able to look to world evolution, must conclude it was necessary for man to reach a stage of development at which, looking at only one side of the world and himself, he could speak of ideology. It is equally necessary now for him to attain the view, conviction, power, and courage to infuse this ideology with a spiritually perceived, spiritually experienced world. Otherwise, although perhaps it may be discussed philosophically, the ideology will remain mere ideology. And as we shall see in the second part of these lectures, which will be on, quote, anthroposophy and sociology, close quote, the forces of decline will quite definitely proliferate. Before us, then, are two pictures, spiritual world as reality and world of the senses as Maya, world of the senses as reality and spiritual world as Maya. We need a view of the world and of life that is capable of imbuing the spiritual world, regarded as ideology, with spiritual intuition, spiritual imagination and inspiration, so that what today appears unutterably empty is filled once more with spiritual meaning. At the same time, it must be able to perceive that what the Orient regards as illusion and Maya is a reality in the sense that it is a true and faithful reflection, a transformation of the spiritual world, which was necessary for the evolution of humanity in freedom. If we are to reach an understanding of these two diametrically opposed world pictures, we need a view of the world and of life that can combine them and not just add them together mechanically, one that will develop through its own inner life, not from the one or the other, but in a spiritual progression from the being of man itself. And these world pictures do ultimately affect everything that we experience spiritually. They certainly condition individual features of life and of human attitudes. As a Central European here in Central Europe, I would rather not give my own judgment on this particular point. I prefer to pass on the judgment expressed some years ago by an Englishman who compared Western and Central Europe in relation to a certain aspect of spiritual life. This Englishman wanted to exemplify the way in which spiritual life has revealed itself in particular phenomena. He referred to the appearance at the end of the 50s and beginning of the 60s of the last century of Buckle's important work titled History of Civilization. Buckle, he noted, views history mainly, if not so exclusively as do the Marxists, for example, in terms of economic drives, so that ultimately spiritual life is taken to arise from the action and interaction of economic forces. We do not always have to condemn a view of this kind. We can take a positive attitude and say, since man is in part an economic being, an historical consideration of human life from this standpoint also was needed at a certain stage in humanity's evolution. The Englishman then refers to another book that was produced in Central Europe at the same time as Buckle wrote his title, History of Civilization, Jacob Burckhardt's Civilization of the Renaissance in Italy. The Englishman himself observes that a quite different spirit prevails here. Burckhardt describes how people feel, what their attitude to one another is, and how through the opinions they have of each other, they enter into certain relationships, which in turn determine other events occurring among them. And the Englishman finally sums up, I am simply quoting his opinion here, by saying that Buckle describes man as he eats and drinks, whilst Burckhardt describes man as he thinks and feels. And if I may now add something myself, if, as we have heard, the Westerner looks at the external world of facts and derives spiritual life from it, and the Central European looks at what inhabits the realm of the soul, but the soul in its earthly existence, then one would have to add thirdly that the Easterner, in many respects even the Eastern European, describes man as he preaches and sacrifices. And so we might say, supplementing the Englishman's verdict, in the West man is described as he eats and drinks. I say this in no pejorative sense. In the Middle region, as he thinks and feels. In the East, as he preaches and sacrifices. In this preaching and sacrificing is active what I have described as the attitude of the East. Similarly, in the view of history that has become generally familiar today, and that is also reflected in the notion of ideology, there operates what I have described as the attitude of the West. But we also need to see how in the mode attributed to the Middle, where man is presented as he thinks and feels, the two currents meet. We are called upon today to understand this confluence correctly by taking a first step that will gradually lead us onward to spirituality. I will try to sum up in a single image the two attitudes I have sought to represent, in order to show where understanding is really needed between East and West. To do so, I should like to recall that at a time when the physical sensory world and human existence also was felt as Maya in the East, he who is called the Buddha encountered in his wanderings the most varied manifestations of human suffering on earth. Among these manifestations was a corpse. Death confronted the Buddha, and through contemplation of death, he reached his conclusion, life is suffering. This was the tenor of Oriental civilization, 600 years before the establishment of Christianity. 600 years later, Christianity was founded, and henceforward, we have a significant symbol, the crucifix, the raised cross with the Redeemer, the dead human body on it. In the West, countless people look at this corpse, at the image of it, just as countless people who have become disciples of Buddha have looked at the corpse from which Buddha drew his teaching. The East acknowledged, life is suffering. We long for redemption. Westerners, in looking at the image of the corpse, however, did not simply say life is suffering. For them, the sight of death became a symbol of resurrection, resurrection of the spirit through inner human power. It became a symbol of the fact that suffering can be redeemed by overcoming the physical, that it is overcome not by turning away from it in asceticism, but by keeping it in full view, not by regarding it as Maya, but by overcoming it through work, activity, and the vigor of the will. Out of the introspective life of the East arose a contemplation of the corpse, with the conclusion life is suffering, man must be redeemed from life. Out of the life of the West, striving always for activity, there arose at the sight of the corpse the view life must develop power within itself, so that even the forces of death can be overcome and human work can do its task in world evolution. The one philosophy is old and outdated, yet it contains things of such great value that even though we may treat it as old, we still approach it as something venerable. We honor an elder without expecting him to profess the views of youth. What we encounter in the West, however, has the character of a beginning. We have shown what must become of what appears as ideology in its disposition. It is young. It must develop youthful power in itself, so that it may attain to the spirit in its own way, just as the Orient did. In honoring the Orient for its spirituality, there is something we still need to be clear about. We must build up our own spirituality from the beginning we have made here in the West. We must so shape it, however, that we can reach an understanding with any view that may exist on earth, especially old and venerable ones. This will be possible if, as people of the Middle and the West, we come to understand that although our view of the world and of life has faults, they are the faults of youth. Understanding this is a summons to have the courage to be strong. If, for all our respect, love, and admiration for its spirituality, we take what we need from the East, not with passive receptivity, but with a busy activity rooted in what today is still perhaps unspiritual in the West, yet contains the germ of spirituality, if we add strength to respect, then we shall do what is right for the evolution of humanity. The end of Lecture 4.